from PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iraq, Israel, and the change of power on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert arrived at the White House today at a moment when U.S. policies in the Middle East may be changing. Democratic leaders want a phased withdrawal from Iraq. There's pressure from several directions for talks with Syria and even Iran. All this as the Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, are putting together a unity government. On To the Point, President Bush is embracing advisors who served his father. Will they push diplomacy rather than confrontation? Is there any chance of a weakened American commitment to Israel? On Reporter's Notebook later on, as the new Congress meets the old, what are the prospects on Capitol Hill? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. As Democrats advocate a phased withdrawal from Iraq, is it time for negotiations with Syria and Iran? As Prime Minister Olmert arrives at the White House, is there any chance of a weakened U.S. commitment to Israel? On Reporter's Notebook, old business for the lame duck Congress as Democratic leaders begin to clarify their alliances and objectives for the new Congress. First, this news update. On yesterday's Sunday talk shows, leaders of the Senate's new Democratic majority called for redeployment of U.S. troops in Iraq within months. Here's President Bush at the White House today.
It's an interesting period here in Washington, Mr. Prime Minister. You might realize the opposition party won the Senate and the House. And what's interesting is that they're beginning to understand that with victory comes responsibilities. And I'm looking forward to working with the Democrats to achieve common objectives.
President Bush at the White House today, the Prime Minister he referred to is Ehud Olmert of Israel. Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
With victory comes responsibility. That's an interesting comment from the president in the aftermath of the recent elections. How would you interpret it?
Don't pull out of Iraq too fast, and certainly don't promise any deadlines for doing so. You know, that's been Bush's red line. It was perhaps the main campaign platform that he invoked, along with the top Bush administration officials before the election, which is that, you know, the Democrats are going to cut and run. They're going to send the wrong signal to the radicals that effectively the U.S. has been defeated in the Arab world. So I think that's what he's trying to drive home, this idea that, that now that the Democrats do have some governing responsibilities, they have to be extremely careful on pressing for early withdrawal.
Is that also a way of suggesting that if things continue to go wrong, the Democrats might share some blame for it?
Oh, I think, you know, on the theory that you can't ever completely divide up substantive policy questions from political questions in Washington, which I don't think you can. I'm sure that's in the back of the president's mind and some leading Republicans. There was a strain of thought in Republican thinking that it wouldn't be so terrible if they lost one of the houses of Congress after all in this election, because come 2008, that would give them a chance to, you know, blame the Democrats for some things.
Again, we're talking with Michael Hirsch, who's senior editor at Newsweek magazine. All day long, as we understand it, the Iraq Study Group, led by James Baker, the former Secretary of State, and Lee Hamilton, the former Democratic congressional leader, are meeting. The members of that group are meeting with the Bush foreign policy team. What's expected to come out of that, and what particularly are they likely to do specifically?
Well, I think it's important for people to note that whatever impact the so-called Baker Commission was going to have on Iraq policy, it's already had that impact, namely in the removal of Rumsfeld and the naming of Bob Gates, who was a member of the panel until last week, as the new defense secretary. That, I think, was going to be one of the most controversial recommendations of the commission, and namely that new leadership was needed. Now that's been taken care of. The Bush administration has sort of taken a lot of the wind out of the Baker Commission's sails in that respect. So I think you're going to hear a series of steps recommended by the commission report involving certainly talking more with Iran and Syria. Certainly, almost certainly, you know, trying to co-opt radical elements into the new government, among other things. But I don't think it's going to result in a dramatic shift in policy.
So the Iraq Study Group then would be unlikely, given that one of its members is now to be the Secretary of Defense, to make any recommendations that would affect military policy. They would leave that up to him?
I think that they will certainly make some recommendations on military policy, on the U.S. posture there. But it's important to remember, whatever recommendations they make and whatever the Democrats come up with as far as, you know, their sort of phased withdrawal plan, the circumstances are so dire there now that the options are really limited. I mean, it doesn't matter what party you're from or whether you're inside or outside of the Bush administration. Things are in such a bad state in Iraq that, you know, whoever is making policy is going to be, you know, extremely constrained to the point where I really don't think that what the Bush people will do and what the Democrats will suggest that they do will be that different.
We have only about 30 seconds left, but we're going to be talking in the rest of our program about some of the other things that came up today, including the proposal by Tony Blair, who's going to meet with the Iraq Study Group tomorrow, that there be negotiations, as you mentioned, with Syria and Iran. White House open to that?
More open, I think, than it has been in the past. But, you know, as with so many things, like the removal of Rumsfeld, you know, it's a day late, a dollar short, or in this case, a year late, or 2 years late, something that might have had a lot of impact a year or two ago in terms of bringing Syria and Iran in, I think has much less impact now because it's become such a sectarian war inside Iraq. So I think that that certainly will be something they'll pursue to some degree. Greater than they are now, but I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference.
All right. We're going to be talking once again about that and also some of the other diplomatic ramifications of dealing with Syria and or Iran. Michael Hirsch, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Senior editor, Newsweek magazine. In a moment, once again, we'll be talking about the change of power on Capitol Hill, Iraq, Israel, and how they might be affected on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. British Prime Minister Tony Blair said again today that Syria and Iran can help to bring peace to the Middle East. At his news conference with Prime Minister Olmert, President Bush repeated his long-standing response to that question.
If you want to have a dialogue with us, we're willing to come to the table with the EU as well as Russia and China to discuss a way forward. But first, you must verifiably suspend your enrichment activities.
All day at the White House, again, James Baker's so-called Iraq Study Group has been meeting with the foreign policy team. It's believed that Baker and the new defense secretary-designate Robert Gates favor negotiations with both Syria and Iran. Prime Minister Blair will address the Iraq Study Group tomorrow. Dennis Ross led negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians during the first Bush and Clinton administrations. He's now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
What do you think about the prospects of negotiations, particularly with Iran, and how would that be viewed by Ehud Olmert and the Israelis? No doubt the subject has come up today at the White House.
I think you're absolutely right. I suspect that the Iranian issue was probably foremost on Prime Minister Olmert's list. I'm not sure it was foremost on President Bush's list, but certainly foremost on Prime Minister Olmert's list. I would suspect that the Israelis are probably looking at this issue and saying, it's fine, we don't object to your engaging or negotiating with Iran, but there has to be a consequence, there has to be a result, and the result has to be that Iran gives up its nuclear weapons. I suspect these days the Israelis are increasingly uneasy about what they see as a diplomatic path that seems to move on slow motion, while the Iranian effort to develop nuclear weapons seems to be moving on an accelerated pace. So the kind of disjuncture between a very slow-motion approach to diplomacy that never seems to impose a price on the Iranians, doesn't seem to affect the Iranian behavior, is causing, I think, an increasing sense among Israelis that maybe this instinct towards diplomacy is rapidly becoming a cover for simply accepting the fact that eventually Iran will go nuclear and we'll all live with it.
Well, now that's based on the notion that Iran is very far along in the development of nuclear weapons, which nobody really seems to be that certain of.
That's true, but here's where I think there is a kind of gap between what the Israelis measure as a source of their concern and what the administration, at least the intelligence community part of the administration, has measured as its main concern. The Israelis look at when will the Iranians cross the threshold that gives them the know-how and the engineering capability to create fissile material on their own so they can then create the basis for a nuclear weapon. It doesn't mean because they have fissile material they immediately turn it into a nuclear bomb, but it means they've crossed this threshold where they don't need help from anybody else to be able to become a nuclear weapon state. The intelligence community here tends to measure it more in terms of at what point do they actually arrive at being able to produce a nuclear weapon. So here's the gap of what between what the Israelis might call the point of no return and what the administration looks at as where they need to be most concerned.
So will the Israelis then, if in fact the United States does enter into some sort of negotiation and there aren't the kind of consequences that you refer to, which I assume is the same as what we just heard from the president, that they have to verifiably suspend their enrichment activities, what are the Israelis likely to do? Is there some possibility that they will take military action on their own?
Well, I think there is, because I think from an Israeli standpoint, they don't look at this threat as an abstraction. Especially in the aftermath of the war in Lebanon, the war with Hezbollah, where Israel was hit with 4,000 rockets, there's a sense that Israel is vulnerable to such an attack and that Iran combines the worst two possible attributes. Number one, a stated, repeatedly commitment to seeing Israel destroyed, eliminated. Even today, again, Ahmadinejad is talking about how Israel will be eliminated, not just that they should be eliminated. And the marriage of that commitment with a absolute determination to develop nuclear weapons makes Israelis look at this from the standpoint of saying this is not a threat that we can somehow wish away. These are not declarations that we can afford to ignore. And if you look at what Prime Minister Olmert's been saying, the world ignored what Hitler said, and we see what the consequences were for the Jews. We in Israel, in a sense, being the product of that, we are not going to forget history. And when we look at the Iranians, don't expect us to simply wish away that threat. We won't. If the world won't deal with it, we will.
There's a lot of concern in Israel expressed in the Jerusalem Post, for example, in a very long article about some of the people involved here, particularly Mr. Gates, formerly with the first Bush administration, also with Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Baker, and the idea that they want to see a negotiation with Iran. A, do you think they will want that? And B, do you think it's a good idea?
Well, I think actually they do favor engagement. I think Baker, as a general principle, believes that you shouldn't be afraid to talk. It doesn't, just because you talk doesn't mean that you go and surrender. So he, I think, would take the view that you should be prepared to talk. It doesn't mean you have to be soft or fuzzy-minded when you do. Bob Gates was co-chaired a committee for the Council on Foreign Relations, I think, the year before last, in which they very much put an emphasis on engagement, not confrontation with Iran. My attitude on the issue of negotiations is something you and I have talked about before. I actually favor the administration being prepared to talk to Iran, but I wanted them to use that readiness to talk as a lever to get others, especially the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, all of whom were eager for us to be open to negotiations, to agree on what sanctions would be, not as a principle, but in concrete terms, so that if, in fact, we engage in a process of negotiations and they don't work out, there's an agreement on what the consequences would be, and the Iranians would know that in advance, so they would see what the price would be in advance. Unfortunately, when we made the decision to announce that we were prepared to talk to Iran, all we got was an agreement in principle on sanctions, and we see even now, having passed a Security Council resolution the end of July stating that August 31st would be a point past which, if the Iranians did not suspend their enrichment and stop all the reprocessing activities, they'd be subject to sanctions. Here we are in the middle of November, and we're discussing a Security Council resolution on sanctions on which we don't yet have an agreement, and those sanctions are themselves quite minimalist, and the resolution in draft form at this point does not even have a deadline. If you have this and the Iranians don't respond, in other words, if you pass this resolution and they don't respond, it's not clear what the next step would be.
Dennis Ross, a former Middle East envoy for the Clinton administration, also pursued a similar role during the first Bush administration, now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Philip Wilcox is retired from the Foreign Service. He's now president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington. He formerly was ambassador at large for counterterrorism and was American chief of mission in Jerusalem from 1988 to 1991. Mr. Wilcox, welcome to you.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
What do you think about negotiating with Iran? Must there be the kind of agreement on sanctions if things go wrong that Dennis Ross suggests?
Well, I think we have to recognize that the rest of the world does not support strenuous sanctions at the moment. It's possible that they might if we were to engage in negotiations with Iran and offer a different agenda. I think the secret to negotiations is to see if there is some room for transforming the American-Iranian relationship in a positive way that would protect our interests and Iran. The nuclear issue would have to be very central to that, but there are other issues as well. There is a potential, I believe, in restoring a wholesome U.S.-Iranian relationship, which will protect the interests of both countries. That ought to be the exploration that we will pursue in negotiations. We don't serve our interests by boycotting Iran and relying exclusively on multilateral negotiations. We need to talk to them directly.
Well, could we do that, though, without getting an agreement from them, as the president always phrases it, and as we just heard him phrase it, that they verifiably suspend their enrichment activity?
Well, it's traditional in diplomacy that you negotiate with your adversaries, usually without preconditions. If you erect conditions which are normally to be the subject of negotiations, then you forestall negotiations. So I would advocate an effort to engage with Iran without preconditions. It's not entirely clear that the Iranians would sign on to that right away, but I think they would. Because Iran is certainly a country that needs to improve its relations with the rest of the world, and restoring relations with the United States, for many Iranians, certainly not all, would be a very valuable asset for them.
What about the reaction of the Israelis to that?
Well, I think the Israelis would welcome any American diplomacy which could reassure them that Iran is not going to build nuclear weapons. They're deeply concerned about that for obvious reasons. I don't think they would oppose direct negotiations or offering some carrots as well as sticks to Iran. Their bottom line is their own national security and the threat of ultimately an Iranian nuclear attack.
Philip Wilcox with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Back to Dennis Ross at the Institute for Near East Policy. We always say that it's unacceptable for either Israel or the United States, President Bush often says for the whole world, for Iran to have nuclear weapons, and yet Israel does have nuclear weapons. Is there any sense in which they ever might be on the table as these complex relationships get resolved?
It's an interesting question. I guess a couple of points are worth making. Number one, the Israelis, of course, have never publicly acknowledged that they have nuclear weapons, although it's probably a general conviction throughout the world that they've had them for some time. Number two, one thing the Israelis made clear to us throughout the whole period when we actually had a peace process, something we have not had for the last 6 years, the Israelis basically said that, look, they were prepared in the context of reaching a peace agreement to also then look at the whole region being an area that would be free of weapons of mass destruction, and that would obviously apply to them as well. Why would they raise it in this context? Well, their attitude, I think, was that having a nuclear capability gives them a kind of ultimate deterrence. And if they have neighbors who are thinking about attacking them from an existential standpoint, this is what would be deterring from that standpoint as well. If it becomes clear that you have peace in the area and it's a real peace, and then you can look to creating a whole different environment, then they wouldn't necessarily need the weapons of mass destruction. So this was something that they were open to in that context.
Philip Wilcox, do you think that it would make a difference to the Iranians if they thought there was some possibility that the Israelis might give up their nuclear weapons, presuming, again, that they have them, as everybody seems to?
I think it's certainly would. I think it would offer the Iranians a deal they simply couldn't reject. But I think there is a possibility of halting the Iranian nuclear fuel development program, even without that kind of reciprocal promise from Israel, if the U.S. Offered in return some kind of security assurances to Iran, restoration of economic ties, an end of sanctions, and a more normal relationship. We have mutual interests with Iran in Afghanistan. Surely we do in Iraq. It is foolish, in my view, for the United States not to engage with Iran on a whole variety of issues. And it is possible, of course, we can't be sure by any means, but we need to explore this, that Iran would drop its nuclear development program in return for other major incentives which we're in a position to offer.
Would Iran be accepting, though, of assurances from the United States, or would the United States be willing to give it, as long as the president of Iran continues to say, as he often does, that he wants to wipe Israel off the map?
Well, he's an erratic and irresponsible demagogue in some respects. It is hardly clear that he's speaking for the Iranian government. In that respect, he has also said, and this is interesting, that he would accept a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians if the Palestinians accepted it. So he said various things, while what he says about the Holocaust and destroying Israel are utterly reckless and irresponsible, it may be that this is bluster and rhetoric, and that there is a more reasonable and pragmatic strain in the Iranian government.
What do you think, Philip Wilcox, about the appointment of Robert Gates, about the presence in the White House today, and as an advisor of sorts, obviously, of the former Secretary of State, Mr. Baker? Do you think that that signals that there may be a change of direction in American policy in the direction that you favor?
Yes, I do. I think unilateralism, extraordinary reliance on military force at the expense of diplomacy has kind of run its course, and I would expect a resort to more traditional policy during the last 2 years of the Bush administration. The Gates appointment is a signal of that, because he was very close to Jim Baker and to the more traditional policy of the former Bush administration. The current policy has not succeeded in many respects, and the U.S. faces a real challenge in an honorable disengagement from Iraq, which will protect stability in the region. We're facing a deep impasse between Israel and Palestine. The problem of Lebanon is very dangerous. So there are a whole host of issues here that are related, which some, including people like Bob Gates, I believe, advocate to go back on the administration's agenda. So I would look for a change of course. And I believe that the Baker-Hamilton report will recommend such changes.
Again, the Iraq Study Group. Philip Wilcox, Dennis Ross, two distinguished former diplomats. We'll come back to both of you, talk to others as well. On Reporter's Notebook, more on the prospects on Capitol Hill on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Once again, talk about the possibility of changes in American policy toward the Middle East with all of the enormous complexities that involves. Again, talking with two former diplomats of ambassadorial rank, Dennis Ross and Philip Wilcox. Let me introduce into this conversation Shibley Talhami. He's Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, author recently of the book The Stakes, America and the Middle East. Professor, good to have you back with us.
Good to be with you.
Interested in your take on what we're hearing from Dennis Ross and Philip Wilcox. And I also want to ask you about developments out of the Middle East today having to do with the possibility of a unity government on the part of the Palestinians. Go ahead.
Well, first, let me just say something on the Iran issue, which I think obviously is a very
difficult challenge to the United States policy. I think Israeli and Iranian interests, Israeli and American interests coincide a little bit on the issue of Iran, but they're not identical. The Israelis are looking at it from the point of view of their long-term deterrence and indeed survival, and they make an assessment on that as a top priority, and they're willing to pay a heavy price on other issues if that if that's what they have to pay. The U.S. simply cannot do that. They obviously don't want Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, and certainly not for Iran to be in a position to attack Israel. But the U.S. also has to worry about the consequences of any action it might take vis-a-vis Iran on its other interests, whether it's interest in the Middle East, in Iraq, the rest of the Arab world, and its presence in the Gulf. After all, Israel is actually very far from Iran. Iran may have some dozen missiles that could hit Israel at the moment, but American forces are right next door now to Iran, and that's a double-edged sword for the United States. There are obviously global consequences. I think the issue really isn't whether the U.S. should engage Iran or not. I think the U.S. is going to have to engage Iran in some way. Without direct negotiations, you're not going to have be able to explore what's possible with Iran. I think the problem is that the American policy is already in a bind by virtue of saying we will just simply not tolerate Iranian nuclear weapons. And I think even if you negotiate, you enter into a negotiation and the Iranians say no, which is really quite possible. I know that Ambassador Wilcox is optimistic about the possibility of putting a package together. It may be possible. I wouldn't say it's impossible. But I think the probability is that if they, in fact, are close to nuclear weapons, they would rather have that than any assurance they may have. And so I think the bottom line is, then what? Are we advocating war? Because we're on a slippery slope. You start a negotiation, they don't pay off, and then you've already raised the expectation, and you're on a slippery slope to war, either Israel attacking Iran or the U.S. Taken action. And I think that's really the problem. And I think that it's something that we have to consider very much, because that decision has to be made beforehand. And I think in some ways we're already on a slippery slope, having raised the expectation. I see that as problematic, because I think a war is very easy to start, as we know, and very difficult to end. Even those who think that it's just an operation, you can just hit Iran and it's over after, you know, you set them back by 5 years, which is possible. But then, of course, you start a war and you're at war, and that war could last for a long time. And I think that's where the decision is not just about starting a negotiation. I think one has to make an a priori decision about how to proceed in case those negotiations fail.
You say that we're in a bind because we've said we won't tolerate Iranian nuclear weapons. Dennis Ross was just saying that if they think we're going to tolerate Iranian nuclear weapons, then Israel might well take military action on its own. How do you avoid that?
Well, I think you can't avoid it, and frankly, the Israelis will in the end make up their own mind on that, and you know, because they make their own decisions. I think whatever decision the Israelis make, obviously, are consequential for the U.S. It's very hard to imagine the U.S. would stand still if the Israelis and the Iranians got involved in war, and so it obviously has to be coordinated to the extent possible. But I think from the Israeli point of view, while many are pushing for that kind of option, I think from the Israeli point of view, it would be a big mistake to just take a risk by assuming that you're going to delay Iran by 5 years while having unleashed a war with Iranians, with Persians, that might last decades. In terms of, there are no real issues of animosity today between Persians and Israel, between Iran and Israel. There's some ideological difference. You have a government that has a particular take on the issue of Israel, but you don't have profound issues that are bilateral that are important. And if you start a war, you've defined a relationship in a way that could haunt that Israeli-Iranian relationship for decades to come. And so I think that one has to be very careful here in terms of pushing very rapidly with the idea that that's a solution to the problem.
Do you think that you say that the United States and Israel have their differences with regard to Iran and other things as well? Has the United States come to be too close to Israel?
Well, it's a good question. Look, the United States is going to support Israel today and tomorrow and the day after. And I think if Israel's survival is at stake, every American government, Democratic or Republican, is going to come to Israel's aid. And the U.S. will, the Israeli-U.S. relationship will be different from the American relationship with the Arab world in any foreseeable future. The question is whether, in fact, the closeness of the relationship is helpful or hurtful. At some level, that relationship is helpful to Israel. And to the U.S., one can argue. I think that at some level, the Israelis are projecting deterrence, saying, you cannot defeat us without defeating the United States of America. At another level, it's hurting Israel, because when the U.S. is seen to be weak, as happened in as a consequence of Iraq, the American support for Israel and Lebanon, Arabs believe that that the Hezbollah defeated Israel and Lebanon despite total American support, and that doesn't give you this protection, psychological protection level, as well as it has not enabled the U.S. to put forth proposals for mediation that Israel needs at the end of that war that were taken at face value as mediating. As mediation offers. So I think you can make an argument that distancing is helpful to both, and I think this is a good point to reconsider that, particularly when you have the Prime Minister of Israel visiting and meeting with the President at the White House.
Shibli Talhami, again, Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Emil Saliya is the Associate Professor of Middle East Politics and International Relations at the University of North Texas. His books include West Bank Policies Since 1967 and Jordan, Domestic Policies and Foreign Policies. He is an American citizen of Palestinian descent. Professor, welcome to you.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think that there is a prospect of a distancing between the United States and Israel, particularly, once again, to refer to Israeli newspapers of late, when there is concern about the renewed involvement in American policy of Secretary of State Baker and now, of course, Robert Gates in the event that he's confirmed as the Secretary of Defense?
If I may first take the opportunity to comment on the things that my colleagues commented on, Iran and the United States and nuclear weapons. Just very briefly, what I would argue is we are in the situation that we are in right now is because of our policy in the Middle East, and especially in Iraq. What do you expect from Iran when we classify it as member of the Axis of Evil? We attack a country that didn't have nuclear weapons, and look at the devastation that you have in Iraq. In the meantime, we have not done anything about a country that is, in my mind, unstable like Pakistan, that Musharraf could be overthrown, and what we have done about it. I think it's a total failure on our part of how to deal with the question of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and this unilateralism that we have adopted in the region is not going to lead anywhere, and that's why we really need to engage the Iranians without any preconditions. And it's only through confidence building and trust on the long term that the Iranians may give up their nuclear weapons. And as my colleague Shibli mentioned, maybe by that time they would have the nuclear weapons, and then we'll simply have to accept it as we accepted India and Pakistan nuclear weapons.
What about the relationship between the United States and Israel?
With regard to Iran?
Yes. Well, with regard to whether or not the United States has become so close to Israel that it has hampered its flexibility in diplomacy.
Yes, that is, again, for the sake of the Israelis and for the sake of the United States, we have to distinguish our relationship from Israel. Israel is a regional Middle East state. We are a global power. Now, look what happened yesterday, for instance. There was no reason to veto the Security Council resolution, our support, total support to Israel in Lebanon during the summer, again depicted us as supporters of Israel, regardless of what Israel does. And on top of that, if you take the miserable situation in Iraq and our support to Israel, who is going to win out of all of that? Only extremists, fundamentalists, that gain popular support on daily basis because, again, of our policy. We have to be more foresighted in our approach. We are not going to ever abandon Israel. But, you know, diplomatic gestures and public gestures could help also our image in the Middle East and try to reduce the appeal of Islamic radicalism. And that's why, you know, another theme, you know, I don't want to open it up, but, you know, our support to democracy. It's nothing but rhetoric, and the administration has, in my mind, failed miserably on that side as well.
What do you think about the takeover of the Congress by the Democrats? Do you think there's going to be any kind of pressure on the Bush administration to change the relationship or alter the relationship with Israel?
I don't think you are going to see that. You know, the support to Israel is well established within the Congress. You're not going to see that. What you will see is adjustment of our policy in Iraq. So our, you know, diplomatic stature in the Middle East hopefully will change. I'm so glad to hear that we are going to open dialogue with Iran and Syria. We should have done it before. Probably the situation would have been by far better. And again, these negotiations should not be, no preconditions should be attached to them. But I honestly don't expect that Bush is going to do anything. The last 2 years of his administration, he gave a speech on June 20th, 2002, that by 2005 there will be an independent Palestinian state. Unfortunately, the president forgot his speech.
Emil Saliya, once again, associate professor at the University of North Texas. Dennis Ross, back to you, a former negotiator for the former first Bush and Clinton administrations. I've heard a lot of different ideas since we spoke with you last. Let me ask you about what we just heard about the comparison of Iranian nuclear weapons to Pakistani and North Korean nuclear weapons, and whether the Iranians, having been accused of being part of the Axis of Evil and seeing the United States attack Iraq when it didn't have nuclear weapons, isn't in some sense justified in deciding that that's what it needs.
Well, I don't know if it's justified. I think it certainly has a point of view. There's no doubt that in the case of the Iranians, that they have wanted a nuclear weapon for a long time. They didn't keep their nuclear activities hidden from the international community and the IAEA, the Nuclear Watchdog Agency, for 17 years because, in fact, they had above-board intentions when it came to the whole nuclear issue. Do they want nuclear weapons? I think it's unquestioned that they do. Do they have multiple reasons for wanting them? Yes, including defensive ones. I suspect that one of their reasons for wanting them is to deter us. I have no doubt that's the case. But I think they also have offensive reasons for wanting them, including they want to dominate the region. So the question is not whether it's a good thing for them to have nuclear weapons. I think it's clearly not a good thing for them to have nuclear weapons. The question is, what is the best way to try to deal with this as an issue? And not diminishing the fact that there should be other concerns out there. But in the case of the Iranians are the ones who are out there saying that there's another member state of the UN that shouldn't exist, and they repeat it on a very regular basis. I mean, all you have to do is pay attention to what they say every week, and you see this is an article of faith. So that's obviously a source of concern, and they should be treated differently because of that. You know, the Iranians are members of the NPT. That's a fact. They are entitled to receive help in developing civil nuclear power. That's a fact. They're not entitled under the terms of the agreement to keep their nuclear activities hidden in secret, and for the last 4 years after having been exposed, they still haven't responded to the IAEA and Dr. Albarde's questions. So it's pretty clear that they would like to have all the privileges that go with certain kinds of international conventions. They just don't necessarily want the responsibilities.
Dennis Ross, once again now at the Institute for Near East Policy. Philip Wilcox, again, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. We haven't talked at all about Syria. We've talked about the region in general. But it's my understanding that, again, Syria is not only a player, but one which Secretary Baker, Pentagon Secretary Designate Gates, and others want to deal with. There is some sentiment, as I understand it, amongst the Israelis that they want to deal with Syria. In fact, Prime Minister Olmert said that today at the White House, although he sees great difficulties. But has the United States been in the way of negotiations between Israel and Syria?
I don't know if the United States has emphatically warned Israel not to negotiate with Assad, but I think there have been that's been the That's been the implicit message from Washington, that it is better to isolate and bring international pressure on the Assad regime for its suspected role in the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, for its encouragement of the Hezbollah and serving as a conduit for arms to the Hezbollah. So I think that some people in administration at least believe strongly that this is not the time to talk to Assad or to encourage renewal of Israeli-Syrian negotiations. There are other Americans with long experience who say that this is a very good time for both Israel and the United States to reengage with Syria because it is an influential, pivotal power in the region, that by doing so, we might gain some Syrian support for a way out of Iraq. We might be able to transform an American-Syrian and an American and an Israeli-Syrian relationship in a way that would blunt the threat from the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and help stabilize Lebanon. And above all, one of the greatest prizes would be peace between Israel and Syria.
Let me, if I may, go back to Professor Salia on that question. What would Israel have to gain, what would the United States have to gain by negotiations with Syria?
I think we could gain really a lot. First of all, if we engage Syria as well as Iran, both of them could be very influential with Iraq. At least they are Muslim countries. In the case of Syria, it's an Arab country. It could appeal to the Ba'ath inside Iraq, and we could bring some sort of stability to Iraq. This is a great accomplishment. And, you know, question of Hariri, of course, is a critical issue that could be handled later on, but we should look at our priorities and what is more significant than others. Just to argue that we should not talk to Syria because of this and that, and then look at the consequences that we are seeing in Iraq, that not that Syria is responsible for it, but if they could help, why not? And that's really the way I look at it. Also, Syria, for instance, and its support sometimes to radical Palestinian groups, if you can bring that on board, I think that would be really something positive that we should do, and we should not just have a myopic focus on Syria's role in the assassination of Hariri, which is, you know, apparently Syria is responsible for.
Professor Talhami, do you have anything to add to the utility, if you, that's what, the way you see it, of negotiating with Syria?
Well, I would say, first of all, if the Israelis really want to negotiate with Syria and make it a priority, which means pay the price, which is withdrawing from the Golan Heights, the United States is unlikely to stand in the way. I know there are people now in the administration who are discouraging that, and no question about that. But I think it's a priority for the Israeli foreign policy. It'll stick, and I think the Israelis are going to have to make that decision. The United States simply cannot deliver the Golan Heights to Syria. Israel can, and I think in the end, the American decision is tied to the Israeli decision inevitably, because the United States really has very little to offer Syria. Syria's primary incentive is getting back its Golan Heights, and that's why this relationship is triangular. It is not just a bilateral American-Syrian relationship.
As I said, enormously complicated situation. We don't have time to go in detail into all of the issues involved, but thank you all very much for helping us out today. Shibli Talhami again at the University of Maryland, Emil Salilia at the University of North Texas, Philip Wilcox, Foundation for Middle East Peace, and Dennis Ross of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks, all of you. Look forward to the next conversation with everyone. The Lame Duck Congress is meeting again this week as the new one starts to get organized. In a moment, we'll hear what's happening on Capitol Hill on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
Mormon Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Jonathan Weissman is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Jonathan, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Nancy Pelosi, much talked about, presumably the next Speaker of the House of Representatives, number three in line to the president in terms of constitutional secession. She made an endorsement today of a leadership position that was something of a surprise to a lot of people. Tell us about it.
Well, she endorsed for the House Majority Leader's position John Murtha. Murtha, a lot of people know, has made quite a name for himself in recent months for his very outspoken stand pushing for a near immediate withdrawal from Iraq. And he's a decorated combat Marine, and is a good face to put on the Democrats' Iraq policy. He is challenging Steny Hoyer, who's currently the House Minority Whip for the majority leader's position. And that position was really Hoyer's to take. He'd been lining himself up to move up the food chain for quite some time, and suddenly Jack Murtha jumps in. By all counts, Hoyer still had the inside shot at it. But now, with Pelosi's endorsement, it becomes much more difficult and to forecast what's going to happen on Thursday.
Is that going to create some problems having to do with ethics?
Well, there have been all sorts of questions about Mr. Murtha's activities on the Appropriations Committee. He's kind of a consummate appropriator, and he has channeled a whole lot of money to his home district, and he's channeled a whole lot of money to defense contractors who have gone through a lobbying firm called the PMA Group that is headed by a former staff member of Murtha's named Paul Magliocchetti. And Magliocchetti, in turn, and his clients have given Mr. Murtha a whole lot of campaign money.
It sounds, on the face of it, something like the kinds of things we've been referring to as the scandals of the Republican Congress. Has anybody charged that there's been wrongdoing?
Absolutely. In fact, the Committee for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which has taken a whole lot of shots at Republicans today, took a very big shot at Nancy Pelosi, saying that her backing of Murtha flew in the face of her statements that this is going to be the most ethical Congress in history. And they're accusing her basically of using this culture of corruption as a campaign theme, but as soon as she got a chance, she just turned a blind eye.
Have the Republicans had anything to say about that?
No, not a thing. I think they are very much content to let the Democrats shoot this one out.
Jonathan Weissman, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. While that's going on, of course, the lame duck Congress is meeting. What business is it expected to actually accomplish before it adjourns forever?
Very little. They have only passed something like 9 of the 11 appropriations bills that they need to keep the government functioning. They basically punted on the most difficult ones before the election because they didn't want to have a big intra-party Republican fight before the election. Well, now they're coming back, and the Democrats are going to be taking charge in a couple of months, so the Democrats aren't in any mood to approve bills that they don't like. They know that they can just hold these things back and then take a shot at them when they control the place. And the Republicans just are in no mood to really work very hard. So they're going to come back this week, do virtually nothing, leave for 2 weeks, come back in December, see if there's anything, any low-hanging fruit they can tackle. Mostly they're just going to punt it all until next year and say, yep, the Democrats wanted this, they're going to have it.
What's going on the Senate side? We talked about the House and the leadership struggles there. It's my understanding the Democrats don't have anything quite that dramatic, but the Republicans have a lot of uncertainty, do they not? Because their majority leader, Mr. Frist, is leaving.
Yeah, but, you know, they had pretty much lined it all up. Lamar Alexander will take over the Senate Minority Whip position. Mitch McConnell will move up from that position to the Senate Minority Leader. The Senate's pretty much taken care of. Now the House Republicans have a real Donnybrook coming, and it'll be very interesting to see how the House Republicans handle this, because many of the most conservative House members have concluded that the real problem that they had on last Tuesday was that they weren't conservative enough. And these very conservative, reform-minded people like Mike Pence of Indiana and John Shadegg of Arizona are challenging the existing Republican leadership. And if they get elected on a very uncompromising stand towards small government conservatism, it's going to create a real problem for the Democrats, who are saying they want to work in a bipartisan fashion, and also for President Bush, who who has made overtures toward the Democrats and said he is willing to work in a more bipartisan fashion. But if the conservatives come to power and the House leadership, then whatever overtures he makes to the Democrats will now be in direct contravention to where the House Republicans think they should be going.
Sounds as if any predictions that might be made about the next to Congress will be inoperative within an hour and a half of their being made.
That's right. We're in an extremely fluid place right now.
So any policy issues expected to be resolved in any way before the new Congress is sworn in?
Well, they'll probably confirm Robert Gates to be the next defense secretary, but that's probably about it.
You don't think they'll get to Ambassador Bolton at the UN?
No. No, because Ambassador Bolton still does not have enough votes to get out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It's remarkable that Lincoln Chafee actually lost his election, re-election run, the Republican from Rhode Island. And you would think that in losing, he would just not care anymore. But in fact, he does care. He says he even more than before, he will not support John Bolton to be the UN ambassador. And so the Republicans just don't have the votes.
Jonathan Wiseman, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Katie Cooper and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Phoebe Zimmerman. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com. Click on News. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.